Looking at Mark's Gospel, that's what we do on Sunday mornings. We're in the second half of Mark's Gospel, and we're really in the last week of Jesus' life. This is the countdown to the cross. Jesus has come into Jerusalem on a donkey. He's examined the temple and overturned the tables of the money changers and driven out the animals. And now it's the morning after the night before. That's where we are, at the end of chapter 11. So you might want to open that passage from verse 27 of Mark chapter 11. Bertrand Russell, last time we were in this chapter, I quoted him. He was one of the reasons why he was not a Christian, he said, was because of the cursing of the fig tree. And he didn't know whether to call himself an atheist or an agnostic, apparently. It depends who I'm speaking to, he said. Once he was arrested for protesting against taking part in an anti-nuclear demonstration, and he was sent to prison. And the prison guard, on his arrival, asked what his religion was. And he said, agnostic. And the prison guard apparently said, well, there are lots of religions. I suppose we all worship the same God, don't we? Is agnosticism a religion? What is it to be an agnostic? Someone has described an agnostic as a man who wears both belt and braces, just in case. He doesn't want to believe in God, but he's not going to deny him either, just in case. He's keeping his options open. And so he says, I don't know. That's what the word agnostic means. That's where it comes from. It just simply means don't know. And that's the stance, apparently, taken by the religious establishment here towards the claims that Jesus makes to messiahship. Look at verse 33. We don't know, they say. We don't know. They shrug their shoulders. And apparently, they are agnostic about Jesus. At least they say they are. So let's look at that. Let's examine their position this morning. I hope you've got the passage open in front of you. There's an outline to the talk there at the end, at the back of the service sheet. But first of all, it's a question of authority, isn't it? So you notice how the passage opens, verse 27. They arrived again in Jerusalem. It's the morning after the night before. They're still clearing up the mess that Jesus has made in the temple. And you can imagine how furious they are. And Jesus comes back into the temple courts, we're told. And the chief priests, the teachers of the law, and the elders, that's the entire religious establishment. They are the head honchos, if I can put it that way. They all come together, and they shirt front him, if I can use that expression. Who gave you the right to do that, they say? By what authority did you do that? They're very angry with him. And fair enough, you'd imagine, wouldn't you? I mean, if somebody walked into your house and started overturning the furniture, you'd be pretty put out, I think, wouldn't you? I used to do that to the kids sometimes when they were growing up. I used to work from home in my study, and when I was wrestling with a sermon, if I got to a point where I was stuck, I would just go into the kids' bedroom and rearrange the furniture. To drive them crazy. And then Ruth pointed out to me that verse, in Ephesians, where it talks about fathers not exasperating their children. So I stopped doing it. But you can imagine how annoying that is. No wonder they're angry with him and annoyed with him. And remember, this is a very big deal because this is Passover time. This is the biggest event in the religious calendar. And there are people in Jerusalem from all over the world, and Jesus has just walked into the temple as if he owns the place. And he's kicked over the money changers' tables, and he's driven out the animals, and he's interrupted the worship of the temple. It would be like someone walking into the House of Lords during the state opening of Parliament and interrupting the Queen's speech. That would certainly get into the news, wouldn't it? Who does this man think he is? What gives him the right to come in here and do that sort of thing? That's what they say to him. Who gave you the right to behave like that? See, these are the head honchos, if I can put it that way. The scribes, the chief priests, the teachers of the law, the elders, they're the custodians of the temple. They're the guardians of the temple. They're the tenants, as we'll see when we get into the parable that Jesus tells. They are the tenants. Trouble is, they think they're the owners, don't they? It's God's house, and they're the tenants. But they say to him, "What gives you authority to behave like that?" I mean, often people talk like that, don't they? "I've got my own religion. Thank you very much. I've got my own religion." And the implication is, who are you to come charging in here, upsetting my beliefs? Religion is a private affair. What right have you got to challenge what I believe? That's what they're doing. They're questioning Jesus' authority. We're suspicious of authority more and more these days, aren't we? So in the old days, you'd go, when I was growing up, if there was something wrong with you, you'd go and consult the doctor because he was the authority. He'd had 7, 8 years of training and years of experience, and he knew how to understand your symptoms. So you'd go and you'd consult the doctor and you'd do what he'd say. He was the authority. But nowadays, what do? We Google our symptoms, don't we? And of course, we find out that we've got something very seriously wrong with us, because if you Google it, you've always got cancer or something like that. And then we go to the doctor and we tell the doctor what's wrong with us. And if he doesn't agree with us, we go and find a second opinion, don't we? We're suspicious of authority figures. And these religious leaders, they're suspicious of Jesus. They question his authority. That's what's happening here. But you notice what Jesus does. He answers their question with a question of his own, doesn't he? Look at verses 29 and 30, 29 to 30. And Jesus often does this, by the way. It's a good technique if you're ever in a conversation with someone, to answer a question with a question of your own. Jesus, he does it. We're going to see this next week in chapter 12. He does it all the time. Jesus said to them, "Let me ask you a question." Verse 29. "Answer me, and then I'll tell you by what authority I'm doing these things. I'm not going to tell you until you answer my question. John's baptism, was it from heaven or of human origin? You tell me." Now, that's absolutely brilliant. You see, he's got them, and they know it. Because if they say from heaven, then they have to recognize Jesus. Because John pointed to Jesus. Remember what John said about Jesus? "After me comes one who is greater than I, whose shoes I'm not worthy to untie." If they say that John's baptism was from heaven, they will have to acknowledge who Jesus is. And they don't want to do that. But if they say from men, well, that really does put the cat amongst the pigeons, doesn't it? Because, they're not conviction politicians. Isn't it such a pity? There aren't any conviction politicians around anymore. They've got their eyes on the polls, haven't they? They're looking at what the people are going to do. They know that if they say that John's baptism, however much they might want to, if they say that John's baptism was from men, it was just of human origin, then they're going to lose the support of the people. So instead, what do? They just shrug their shoulders and they say, "Well, we don't know. We don't know. We're agnostic." Now let's take a closer look at this, their agnosticism. See, they've questioned Jesus' authority, and now he answers their question with a question of his own, which puts them on the defensive, and at the same time, it reveals what is really going on in their hearts. It's not that they've got intellectual doubts about the identity of Jesus. It's much worse than that, isn't it? Look what happens here. Verse 31. They discussed it amongst themselves. And they said, "Well, if we say from heaven, he'll ask, then why don't you believe him? But if we say of human origin," they feared the people, for everyone held that John really was a prophet. So they answered Jesus, "We don't know." Reminds me of how I used to do my maths homework when I was in school. I used to do it backwards. Often you had a sneaking suspicion what the answer should be. Sometimes, if you were lucky, the the textbooks we used to have had a key at the back with the answers. And sometimes that's the way I used to do my maths homework. I'd start with the answer, and then because that wouldn't, just putting the answer down wouldn't satisfy the teacher. You had to show that you'd worked it out for yourself. And so I'd start with the answer then and work backwards. That's cheating, of course. And that's what these men are doing. They know what answer they've got to give. And there's no way they're going to admit that John's baptism is from heaven. But neither are they going to be brave enough to say that it wasn't. And so they say, just say, we don't know. We're agnostic about that. But here's the point, you see. Is their agnosticism the result of a reasoned study of the evidence? Of course it isn't. It's just a cloak for their guilt, isn't it? You know, like the child who's been caught red-handed in some misdemeanor, and the teacher says, well, what have you got to say for yourself? I don't know, miss. No, the bathroom floor is swimming with water, and the tap is still running, and your three kids are in there with their water pistols. What's going on here? Why is the floor so wet? We don't know. Of course they know. They're just not going to say. It's going to get them into trouble. See, these people have already made up their minds about Jesus. We know that, don't we? If you go look back at verse 18 of chapter 11, we're told there that these people, the chief priests and the teachers of the law, had begun looking for a way to kill him. They feared him because the whole crowd was amazed at his teaching. So they're already started to plan and to plot as to how they can get rid of him. They claim to be agnostic, but their minds are already made up. They want him out of the way. So they answer Jesus, we don't know. And then Jesus says something, and this is really, I think, very challenging for us. Jesus says, well, neither then will I tell you by what authority I'm doing these things. I want you to see that. I want to pause here a bit. At the risk of going off track, I want to just pause there for a moment to apply this. You see, Jesus has gotten, if you are not a genuine agnostic, if you're just playing head games, if your so-called agnosticism is just, you know, a way of saying, well, I can't be bothered to think about this right now. Anyway, I don't think it's very relevant anyway, so who cares? I don't know. If that's the kind of person you are, I want to say to you, Jesus has got nothing to say to you. This is very important. There's a principle here, I think. Because if you are genuinely searching for God, if you are a genuine agnostic and you really want to know, then you need to get this principle. God reveals his truth only to those who are willing to receive it and act upon it. That's the principle. God will reveal himself. God will reveal his truth only to those who are willing to receive it and to act upon it. Jesus said that, didn't he, in John chapter 7 and verse 17. He says to the disciple, do you want to find out if my teaching comes from God or not? Do you really want to know? You want to be sure about this? Do you want to find out whether my teaching comes from heaven or I've just made it up? Do you want to find out? And then he says this, anyone who chooses to do the will of God will find out whether my teaching comes from God or whether I speak on my own authority. See, it's the exact opposite of what people want us to do. They'll say, well, prove to me that Jesus is God and then I'll follow him. Now, that's not the way it works. That's putting the cart before the horse. Christianity cannot be proved first and practiced afterwards, according to Jesus. The proof is dependent on the practice. The proof of the pudding is in the eating. Jesus doesn't say, well, if it's true, you know, then you can follow my teaching. He says, no, follow my teaching, and that's how you'll find out whether it's true or not. Rebecca Manley Pippitt has a very good book on evangelism called Out of the Salt Shaker. Many of you probably read it. So it's been in print for a long time now. And in that book, she tells a very amusing illustration of this. She tells the story of a young student, a very bright student called Sue, who was an agnostic. She'd had some contact with Christians. One of her friends had become a Christian and it had made a big impression upon her. She had begun to read the Bible for herself, and she'd seen things there about Jesus that really had, again, quite an impression on her. But she still had lots of doubts. She couldn't really. She hadn't yet come to faith. She said, "I don't believe. What should I do?" And so she was told by her friend, by Rebecca Manley-Pippet. She told her, "I'll tell you what you should do: read the scriptures and look for an opportunity to put them into practice." And so she started having what she called her pagan quiet times, because she didn't really know whether there was a God or not. And so she began to pray and read the Bible. One day she said, "I read in the Bible, if someone steals your coat, don't let him have only that, but offer your cloak as well." For whatever reason, that verse hit me between the eyes, she said. So I said to the four walls, "Listen, four walls, or God, if you're there, I'm going to do what this verse says if the opportunity crops up today." And then she immediately forgot that she'd read that verse. She headed out to the library to work on her PhD. And as she sat down at her designated thesis desk in the library, up comes this guy who starts yelling at her. And he's obviously out of control. He tells her that the school hadn't given him his desk, so he's going to take hers. Immediately she started yelling back. They had quite a row. She'd been given a desk by the school. He hadn't, and he wanted her desk. He's going to take it from her. Anyway, to cut a long story short, he just said to her in the end, "Look, I'm stealing it from you, whether you like it or not." And then she said, suddenly it hit me. I just looked at him and moaned. "Oh, no," she said, "I can't believe it." And I thought to myself, "Look, God, if you're there, I do want to know if Jesus is God, but isn't there some other way of finding out?" I mean, I'll give up the desk and then discover that you don't exist. Is there some other way of finding out? Anyway, eventually, after cutting a long story short, because she had to go and talk to the authorities and so on, and then they were ushered into the principal's office and all the rest, in the end, she said to this guy, "You can have my thesis desk." And as they were walking out, she out of the door, he grabbed her by the arm and he said to her, "Why in the world would you do that? Why in the world would you give me your thesis desk? Are you crazy?" And I told him, she said, that he probably thinks that I've flipped out, but I was just trying. I'm trying to discover if Jesus really is the way to God. If Jesus really is who he claimed to be. I'm trying to do the things that he told us to do. So I've been reading the Gospels, and today I read that if somebody tried to rip me off, I was supposed to let them and even throw in something extra to boot. So I'm going to give you the desk, but don't press your luck about something extra. Then he asked me, "Why in the world would Jesus say such a crazy thing?" I said, "Hey, if there's one thing I've learned from reading about Jesus and meeting these Christians, it's that Jesus wants to give us a whole lot more than a thesis desk if we let him. I think the basic idea is that it's knowing Jesus that makes us rich, not owning possessions. So that thesis desk is yours." And then she said to her friend, "Becky, as I said those words, I just simply knew it was all true. I knew it from the inside out. I kind of felt like God was saying, 'Well done. That's the way I want my children to behave.'" Do you see the principle? It's a very important piece of advice there, I think. If you are a genuine agnostic, really searching, wanting to know, Jesus says, "Give it a go. Then you'll know. Put the authority of Jesus to the test. And you'll know if he is from heaven or not." That's the principle. So, to get back on track again, to sum up so far, you see, they question Jesus' authority. And Jesus refuses to answer them, or rather he answers their question with a question of his own, which puts them on the defensive and actually then reveals what is in their heart. And to drive that point home, he tells a story. It's not his own story. It's not original to Jesus. As we heard in the readings, it's from Isaiah. It's Isaiah chapter 5. It's a parable about a vineyard. This is the equivalent in chapter 12 of the cursing of the fig tree in chapter 11. It's the same message that's coming across here. Just as the fig tree was the emblem of Israel, so Israel is described in the Old Testament as a vine. And so Jesus tells this, as a vineyard rather. And so Jesus tells this story about the vineyard that is set up with a fence and a wine press and a watchtower. And he's talking about them. They know he's talking about them. It says so in verse 12. And this vineyard is talking about Israel, God's people. God has chosen this nation, and he's planted it, and he's protected it over the years, and it's fully equipped to serve him, and he sent his prophets to call them back again and again and again, and they've refused to listen. Israel's leaders have rejected, imprisoned, stoned, and killed the prophets, God's servants. Isaiah was sawn in half. Did you know that? Zechariah was stoned to death. John the Baptist, the last and the greatest of the Old Testament prophets, was beheaded. And now what? Now what? Look at verse 6. Now the Son is here. Do you see verse 6? Look, he had one left to send. He'd sent messenger after messenger after messenger, pleading with his people, pulling them back into the covenant, reminding them of what they were there for. He'd sent messenger after messenger. And now we're told he's had just one left to send, a son whom he loved. He sent him last of all, saying, surely they will respect my son. And that's the message of John's baptism, isn't it? Remember how Mark's gospel begins? It doesn't begin with a Christmas story. Where does Mark's gospel begin? Chapter 1, remember? You can flick back if you want to, but don't bother. You remember where it begins? It begins at the Jordan River with the baptism of Jesus. When John takes Jesus and down into the Jordan River and baptizes him. And remember what happens? When Jesus comes up out of the water, what happens? Heaven is torn open. And a voice is heard from heaven. Some people thought it was thunder, but this voice was heard clearly from heaven. This is my beloved Son, in whom I'm well pleased. That's the message of John's baptism. So is John's baptism from heaven or not? It's a very important question, isn't it? Because if John's baptism is from heaven, then Jesus is the son and heir to whom all things belong. God's beloved Son has come into the vineyard. And the challenge is, what are you going to do with him? What are you going to do with him? Do you see what Jesus is doing here in this parable? He's exposing what is in our hearts, isn't he? Look at verse 7. Surely they'll respect my Son, God says. But the tenants said to one another, this is the heir, come, let's kill him, and the inheritance will be ours. So they took him and killed him and threw him out of the vineyard. That's exactly what they were planning to do. We've seen that already. It's as if Jesus is reading their minds, and they know it. And so he throws the question out to them, what then will the owner of the vineyard do? Now, it's very interesting. You see, it's clear from Matthew's account, in Matthew chapter 21, it's clear from Matthew's account that they answer him. It's not so clear here in Mark. You could think that Jesus answered his own question, but Matthew makes it very clear that they actually answer. The story is so compelling. Jesus tells it in such a masterful way. He throws the question out. What then will the owner of the vineyard do? And before they know it, they answer out of their own mouths. They say, well, he'll come and kill those tenants and give the vineyards to others. They're hoist on their own petard, aren't they? They're condemned out of their own mouths, because that's exactly what does happen. In AD 70, the temple is destroyed, never to be built again. And the gospel goes to the nations, as we'll see in chapter 13. Now, we've got to put ourselves in this story. Yes, it's a story about Israel and her leaders, but it has something to say to us too, doesn't it? Sometimes in the current debate that about the redefinition of marriage, for example, we Christians are accused of being on the wrong side of history. I know you probably heard that phrase. It was one of Obama's favorite phrases. All his speeches are peppered with that phrase. You don't want to be on the wrong side of history, do you? We want to be on the right side of history. But what is the wrong side of history? What is the right side of history? People who say that, you know, about the marriage thing, they obviously don't know history, because we've been here before with catastrophic consequences. You just read Gibbon's Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, and you'll see where all this social engineering is leading us. What does it mean to be on the wrong side of history? After all, who wants to be on the? It's just a phrase that's used nowadays to shut down discussion. It's used by the progressives. You know what they're really saying is this: well, you're going to lose eventually, so why don't you just shut up and give up now, and save us all a lot of trouble? That's what they mean when they say you don't want to be on the wrong side of history, do you? And that's the challenge, you see, that Jesus is throwing out here in these verses. Look at verses 10 and 11. So they've asked him a question. He's answered their question with a question of his own and thrown them on the defensive. He's revealed what is really in their hearts. They're plotting murder in their hearts. And now he follows it up with that story of the vineyard, and he clinches it with these closing verses, verses 10 and 11. He says, haven't you read this passage of Scripture? And he quotes from Psalm 118, the stone the builders rejected has become the cornerstone. The Lord has done this, and it is marvelous in our eyes. You see, they're planning to kill the Son. They're going to have him arrested and crucified. They're going to toss him onto the scrap heap of history. That's what they think. There have been lots of messiahs, and they've all ended up in the same way. And they think, well, now here's Jesus, let's do the same to him. They're going to toss him onto the scrap heap of history and forget about him. But what happens? Well, listen to Peter on the day of Pentecost. Let all the house of Israel know that this Jesus whom you have crucified, God has made him Lord and Christ. How? By raising him from the dead, do you see? This stone which the builders have rejected has become the cornerstone. So it's you who are on the wrong side of history, isn't it? You who ignore Jesus, you who reject Jesus, you who write Jesus off. This temple, which looks so permanent, is coming down. Not one stone is going to remain on another. He says that in chapter 13. But God has laid in Jesus the cornerstone of a new temple. That's what history is about. That's where history is heading. That's what God is doing. See, my soul, a structure rising from the wrecks of Adam's race. That's what God is doing. He's building a new temple with Jesus Christ as the cornerstone. This is where God meets with man now, not in some beautiful edifice, but in the person of Jesus. That's how we come into the presence of God now, not through animal sacrifices in the temple, but through the once and for all sacrifice of the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world. He is the cornerstone that God has laid. As Tim Keller put it recently on the Gospel Coalition website, since Jesus Christ has been raised from the dead and is coming again, the only way to be on the right side of history is to belong to him. It's to belong to him. So come to him, why don't you? As Peter says in his letter, come to him, the living stone, rejected by men, but chosen by God and precious. And like living stones, be built up into a spiritual house to be a holy priesthood, offering spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God through Jesus Christ. Get in line with him. He is the cornerstone. Build your life upon him like that girl I was telling you about. Come under his authority. But they refuse to do that. And so they pretend that they are agnostic. To them, Jesus was a stone of stumbling and a rock of offense. Literally, you know, literally, there's a picture in that phrase, by the way, the rock of offense. It's the picture of a mouse trap, you know, and the little stick in the mouse trap is, that's what the word means originally, literally, in the early use of the word. That's the picture. Just as the mouse sort of stumbles against the stick and the trap comes down, that's what Jesus is to you. He's either the cornerstone on which you build your life, or he is the one who will trigger off the judgment of God upon your life. It's as serious as that. You can say, I don't know. You can refuse to make up your mind. You can suspend your judgment on Jesus, but God will not suspend his judgment on you. Not to believe, not to recognize the authority of Jesus, according to the Bible, is to be condemned already.